Welcome to the Cognitive Productivity Podcast, a product of Cogzest. We explore the art and cognitive science of using knowledge to become profoundly effective. Visit us at cogzest.com. I'm your host, Luke Beaudoin. Today, I'm talking with Juno Awards-winning Canadian folk singer and songwriter, David Francy. This recording starts a minute into the conversation with David Francy, which means the introductions are not included.
I'm a cognitive scientist, so those are people who kind of study learning and thinking and all that stuff. And I'm interested in experts and experts who use their knowledge to create great products. I don't focus a lot on arts, but I do have kind of a division, if you will, in my little enterprise here. It looks at Jacques Brel and Winston Churchill as a writer. So that's kind of the background. I'm interested, in not just in dry cognition, but in kind of the intersection between thought and affect, so emotions and motivation and moods. So that's kind of background. Okay. So,
all right.
And I heard your song for the first time, and I bought your CD, So Say We All, which you wrote in difficult circumstances. So I was wondering, I see the bags hung up there. It's in a tree, and you're on a 12th floor or something, so you're looking down on it.
And it's
stuck, and it's passive, and it's kind of an artificial thing, and it's hung up there in autumn. I get the sense this is autumn because you're referring to fallen leaves, and it's got no...
But it isn't. It was May, oddly enough, there were all these leaves from last year, blowing around. My dad was on his way out, from life, and he was just like that. I just looked at that, had that rustle, looked at the bag, and thought, that's him. He's hung up there. You can't go forward, and you can't go back.
Oh.
So that's where it came from. There's a line about the firmament displayed below is all the lights in the parking lot that I've seen for 30 years from their building, and then the cars were the shooting stars. And so just one of those embarrassing things. It's kind of, just kind of worked from the balcony,
Oh, I see. Okay, well, you know what? That answers my question. I was wondering, what's the symbolism? And now I've got it, but I've got to think about it afterwards. So you've given me, whoever's going to read this, a great starting point for that.
Good.
Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is emotion. Now, I wanted to run something by you and to see if it resonates in any of your work. Because I've kind of seen it in there, but I don't know if I'm just hallucinating here. So a guy called Professor Aaron Sloman, who's a professor of artificial intelligence in England, and he's written a lot about emotion, and he's developed this theory of emotion that I've kind of latched onto and worked on with him. And he, that we have a key feature here of emotions that we see. It's called perturbance, and that's kind of a state of mind in which certain motives or effectively charged states are insistent, in the sense that they tend to disrupt our attention, right? So, so if you're in love with someone, it's in the perturbance sense of the term, then it's really hard not to think about them. Or if you're angry, then those thoughts come to mind. Or if you're experiencing grief. So there's certain loss of control of attention. And, and it's a bit like, I don't know if you know OCD, but some people are obsessive compulsive and their thoughts just keep coming.
Yeah.
But in this case, there's like affect. So I've looked at your songs in this light, and I think about, for instance, Lucky Man, and there's a lyric there that comes up like three times. That's the song. That's it.
Yep.
That was the song, by the way, that I said, could you play that for me?
Cool.
You said, no, we've got a program, which of course you had, you were doing this with somebody else. But anyways, so that lyric comes up like three times and maybe a repeat. I can't remember. And
it's just three verses, the whole song, no bridge, no nothing.
So it's just
three verses.
That's right. So that thing, there's this repetition. So I've looked for repetition in your songs, and then in the things they do, you ask it like four times plus the repeat. Why do they do the things they do? There's my big preamble, and I just wanted to throw it back to you and say, do you see repetition as being important to emotion, and that do you feel it comes across in some of your songs?
Yeah, I do. And I think, the essence of that song is just that line, for instance, Lucky Man, and that's what struck me the most. Man, it'll be a lucky man who gets to kiss your face, And I drove it home. I thought about a bridge for it, Luke, but Nothing fit. There's nothing came to me that would add to the song. So nothing was serving the song by adding to it. So, as I said, it's just three verses. There's no bridge, no nothing. But it seems to hang on that last the repetitive line, and I think that's what people really pick up on. So I use it a lot in music. Actually, I repeat a lot.
Okay.
Mostly it'd be the salient point of what I'm trying to get across, I suppose. But yeah, I do use repetition. I think it's really wonderful, and I think it's it'll drive home a point without being pedantic. It'll drive home a point without being preachy, and if you couch it in the right kind of melody, I think.
Wow.
I don't like getting when I hear people, like the sort of polemic type writers who get up there and rant and rave, and they kind of hit you over the head. I don't like getting hit over the head. I don't like being shoved in a direction. I like to be led there, and I don't particularly like being preached at by anyone. So I try not to be preachy. I just think, say it and get out kind of thing,
Wow. That's amazing, because you've anticipated something which I kind of felt unconsciously in your song, but now you've really expressed it very clearly for me. So having listened to many of your songs many times, that makes sense. Okay, so
yeah, one more note on that song. Why do the things they do? I got up one morning and I was going to get ready for work and get my tool belt and shit together, and radio came on, and I always listened to CBC Radio, and they had this story about these two little girls in Montreal, 14 years old, man, and they went to the rail yard and stood in front of a tree. 14 years old. I was shattered, because I had a girl 14 years old at the time.
Oh, my.
And I just couldn't stop thinking about it, and so I got the first verse, and I was working on it in the roof that day, and then I thought of my friend Billy Hawes, and Billy was one of the funniest people I ever met, and I thoroughly enjoyed his company. But he was up and down very, very dramatically, in his life, and unfortunately, he just went down and never came up, and he ended up hanging himself. And I just remembered, and the last thing I saw him, it was really weird. I needed new boots, new construction boots, and he came by to visit in Toronto, and I went out to the car with him, and he picks up these boots, and he says to me, "I won't be needing these anymore." And I just thought, he's not going to do any kind of labor anymore, I said, "Oh, thanks, Billy, that's perfect, man." And 2 weeks later, I'm walking around in this dead man's shoes, I held everything together when he died, but 2 weeks later, I'm in an apartment, and I'm painting it and fixing it up and stuff, and I just bawled my eyes out, because I looked down and I thought, "That's Billy's shoes, So.
Oh, my.
Anyway, that's where that came from.
Well, thanks for filling that in for me, and again, for whoever's going to read this, because I didn't know how personal it was.
Everything I write pretty well has come out of, really everything I write comes out of, what's happened to me, so.
Okay.
Even the bad stuff, eh?
So. Yes. Yeah, I remember in 2003 or so when I attended one of your concerts, you mentioned, "I hope you enjoyed this cheery song because it's going to be dark from here." Something like that, you said.
Oh, yeah. I don't write from the light side of things too often, but I think that's why I introduced the songs, because, I know the songs are kind of heavy sometimes, so I try and, I just try and lighten it up with a banter in between and fill people in, of course, but I don't want them to be sitting there brooding on it. I just want them to kind of get the gist of it and, accept it for what it is.
Well, I can tell you, I brought some new people to your music on Friday, and they said they expressed the same sentiment. You're welcome. The same sentiment that I've felt in is that basically you really do introduce each song because you're a storyteller, and it's just great to hear the added introduction to the story. And I saw that your liner notes for your latest album have, each song is introduced with a, each song is introduced, so you get the story. So that's really awesome.
Yeah. I always liked that when I went to shows. Even if they just said, "I wrote this in Burris Rapids and it was a rainy day," I was a huge Coburn fan.
Oh,
even if you said that much, it gave me gave me a location for the song. I thought it was really important to have that. So, and the storytelling just came about because I was all practiced up in the tunes the first show I ever played, and then there was this horrible silence and in between the songs. And I thought, "Oh hell, what next?" So I just told them about the song coming up, made it a bit funny, and that's just how it started. I didn't know I could do it; it just happened.
So it happens very well, I'll tell you that.
Thanks.
So I want to move on to another kind of psychological concept here. And this has to do with with detecting and repairing flaws in our own thinking and our own creation of products, that is. So in kind of the study of education, one thing that stuck out is that, you know, experts tend to, you know, they look back on their own thinking and they look for flaws. They're particularly attuned for flaws, like an A student and a B student might both read the same text and a physics mm-hmm. text or something. And then if you ask them a mm-hmm. question at the end, you give them a quiz on the subject, the A and the B student will, you know, they'll perform at the same level. But if you ask the A student and the B student, what did you not understand in the text? Well, the A student's going to have lots to say about what he didn't get, whereas the B student or the C student won't really have noticed that they didn't get something. So I'm kind of curious about how this plays out in the creative process. So how important in your craft is it to search for and find, you know, flaws in either your own understanding or your work as it's evolving or maybe in the outside world?
Yeah, I think, you know, since we're in the folk tradition, I really feel it behooves us to chronicle our times. I mean, I think that's what we're here for. And theoretically, if we do it well, 100 years from now, people will be listening to the songs and go, oh, that's what it was like back then. You know, mm-hmm. the same way we listen to Trad now. Trad was contemporary at one time. So I do look for flaws in the world, of course, and then I look for a way to deal with it, you know. Mm-hmm. And the same with myself. I know my foibles, you know, rather well, unfortunately. But I try to express them in a way that, you know, people might recognize themselves and stuff, you know, because I'm a very ordinary person, you know what I mean? I was a working guy for 20 years, and I wrote about that. But I was always kind of, I love the simplicity of that. I love the idea that everybody's kind of sharing the same kind of problems. And I used to pick up guys, you know, from the market. I worked with the same boys all the time, and their problems kind of became my problems because I cared about them. And I would try and make sense of things. And the writing always helped me to sort out the world. And as I said, I got into it late at 45, but I was writing for years before that. And I wrote because just that reason, you know, it helped me sort out what was going on in my head, all the things that I was having trouble kind of figuring out. I'd be, you know, puzzled for days. And then Beth would say, Jesus, I hope you write that song soon because you're getting unbearable. And the minute I'd write it, I would feel immediately better. And about the world and have things sorted out. So I don't know if that helps or not, but for me, it was just, I didn't care if I sung it for anybody. I just had to write it.
Interesting. I have a friend, Maurice Gibbons, who's a retired education professor who would really like to hear this. So I'll make sure that he hears this because he's very much into journaling, and he talks about the therapeutic benefits of journaling. Now, this isn't journaling, but it's quite similar.
No.
Okay.
It's kind of like a lazy journaling, I think, really, you know.
So, yeah.
You know
well, okay. I think a lot of people would find it quite difficult journaling. But anyways, now I'd like to move on to another topic, which is, your creation of songs. And you alluded to how you create, well, at least how you created one particular song on Friday night. And I think it was the hockey song, I think, that you
wrote. Oh, the hockey one,
So, I'm wondering, and it's hard to answer this kind of question in the abstract without looking at particular songs. Your overall, I'm just curious about your overall planning process from the time when an idea hits you. Mm-hmm. How do you plan the overall structure and the theme, or do you let just the song lead you, or how does that interplay work between planning and production?
Well, there's. Well, I have to say, I mean, in all honesty, look at, I don't have any planning involved. Like, if I'm going to write about something, I'm hit by it, you know. Like, there's something in there that's drawing me to the subject, whatever it is. It's usually, well, to be fair to myself, it's usually turmoil, you know, and kind of trying to make sense of things. And so the planning process really, the song dictates that, you know, and the planning only happens when I get the first line, then my plan is I'm going to finish this song. Wow. And I'll work on it and work on it. And if I have to wait 2 years for a word, I will. If I have to wait 5 years for one word, I will.
Oh.
I'm in no rush, and I never have been. And some of them, of course, are like automatic writing. You're just writing, and it comes out. But others, you know, you go back to them, and you edit that. And so that's there's no, like, particular plan about writing. It's just that I have to follow wherever the muse goes, and I have to try and put it as succinctly as possible, all these thoughts that are running around in my head. So my only planning is I'm not going to overwrite. That's the only thing. So I have a very good critical side of myself that that won't let me overwrite, I think, and I just follow that. I'm a slave to that, actually. So as far as planning goes, not so much. But once the tune's on, I'm planning on finishing it. I have no real reason or no real process for finishing it other than just keep going on it. And, you know, because I'm writing them in my head, you know, I'd be up there hammering down shingles all day and I'd be just running that tune in my head like steady, you know, steady. And that's what happens, I think. It's that kind of maturation process of that thought, right? You got the initial thought and... somewhere in the back, you remember, you'll get a line. Say, let's say we get the first verse, and it's a good first verse. I know I'm going to use it. Nothing else is coming. Then I'll work away on it a little bit, and then I'll just drop it. And then the next day or the next 2 days, I have this theory that it's like doing crossword puzzles. You know, you can't get those last six clues one night.
Yes.
You go to bed, you get up, you do your job, you do whatever you're doing. You come back the next night, and you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's all done. And I'm thinking, where the hell does that come from? And
yes.
I think it's the exact same thing happens with music. You know, you've got the idea, you've run out of steam on it, but somewhere in the back of your head, there's a part of your brain working on that song. Because the next time you approach that song and you get back to it, you've got all these ideas from God knows where, you know, and you've got lines coming up and everything else. But I really do believe it's the percolation process. And, you know, it just takes time to assimilate things and to assimilate ideas. And the idea is not to go into panic mode. It's just to let the song come when it's ready. And I'll wait forever. I'm incredibly patient. So.
Oh, this is so great. You've just touched on so many interesting themes and given me a lot of insights, and I'm really excited just to be...
man.
For instance...
I was shutting my pants to both this interview because I thought, I don't really understand what I'm doing anyway, but that's great. Thank you for saying that.
For instance, you came back to the theme of the critical side of yourself, saying, but you've got this monitor so that, okay, I won't overwrite, and you talked about incubation, which, you know, in creativity is so... it's something that comes up all the time. Some people think it's a matter of time. Other people emphasize, well, going into a different location because your ideas sometimes get, well, they get tied, not yours in particular. I mean, people's ideas sometimes get tied to their environment. And then if they go to the library or to a coffee shop and all of a sudden it's like they're free to think different thoughts where the solution lies.
That's a great point. I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. And another weird thing for me, Luke, is I write when I'm in motion a lot. You know, I mean, if I'm on a train or a plane or whatever, I'll usually write. You know, I'll write something anyway. I mean, not recently because I'm in a bit of a lull, but I've written a lot of stuff. And I find when you're in motion, I finally figured it out. You know, I do a lot of driving. I write a lot in the car. So I think what's happening is your brain's already engaged. You know, you're trying to drive this car. You're maybe, you know, thinking about a pile of other things. But essentially, you're looking out the window. All these images are coming in, bang, 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 like photographs. And then eventually that just your brain clicking that way just kind of leads you into, you know, maybe just starting a line. And I find it really easy to write when I'm in motion. I just think it primes the pump in a sense, you know. Just and it's like you just said, you know, if you go to another location, it's the same thing. I mean, it's just all of a sudden, that was a great example, actually. You know, you go to the coffee shop and have a coffee, and all those things you were thinking about just kind of relax into your head, and all of a sudden you look at it slightly differently and really in the way you want. So I think that's an incredibly valid point. So.
Okay, thanks for all that. And this leads us into this concept that of hard work and talent. Now, are you? I don't know if you're a fan of Jacques Brel, or you've come across maybe his work.
Oh yeah.
Okay,
I know. I mean, I'm hardly steeped in it or learned in it, but I mean, that's a tremendous writer. You know, just
okay. And you were in Quebec, so and I don't know what
I was.
French, because I'm actually originally from Quebec myself.
I figured that Luc Baudouin.
Oh,
yeah,
right, that's right.
That's,
my name always
gets
in the way.
Well, alackaday, I got to my great shame and continual frustration. I have no head for language whatsoever, and I tried, and I'd be on the job site, and the boys would just be so frustrated with my French. It was so slow; they just like drop into English. So, you know, I can understand what's said to me, but I cannot get the words out until the person's gone that I'm speaking to, and then I can remember. You know, I go into panic, like anxiety or something. So, Well, unfortunately, I'm sadly lacking in that area. Really, to my ultimate shame, you know.
A lot of people would trade in their second language to be able to write well in their first. So Jacques Brel said, you know, in French, le talent, ça n'existe pas. Le talent, c'est d'avoir envie de faire quelque chose, which translates as talent does not exist. Talent, that's the desire to do something. So what do you make of that?
What do you think of that
in terms of, I don't know, art history in general?
Well, I absolutely believe in the desire part. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, you can sit all you like and think about stuff, but unless you have the desire to write about it, you're not going to write a word that's worth anything. So I agree with that. I do think that talent is a bit innate, you know. I mean, sometimes I'm right convinced that a lot of people have talent that they never recognize in themselves or never right. allow themselves to see. And, you know, I knew I could write. It's just there was no drive for me to sing for anybody else or not, but it was that writing process was just so much a part of me that I never really gave it a second thought. So, but I worked on the thing, so I'm going to go with Bella on that and say, talent is, it might be there, but you really do have to work at it to bring it out of yourself. And,
yes.
And the more you do, the better you get, I think. And, you know, I see it in my songwriting students. I've got a girl of mine, she's Annie Russell. She's like 15 or 16. Kid writes like she's 40. I mean, I look at her, and I talk to her as an absolute equal. This kid is a poet and a half. You know, her mom's a writer, as it turns out. But you know, her writing process is incredible. And you know, so but there you go. She's working on it too.
Yes.
She's working really hard at it. So, but for her, it really pays off. So the talent is innate in her, and she's lucky enough to have awoken it, and is driven enough to. To want to do something with it. So I think all those factors come into it, right? You have to have that combination of three things, you know, I think, anyway.
Yes. Well, that pretty much sums up your view, lines up with, well, at least my view of expertise and what have a lot of people in cognitive science take of expertise. And that kind of leads me as we're talking about young people and your own adolescence. And were you a poem writer, a letter writer, a songwriter as an adolescent? Or what kind of writing happened in your adolescence?
Well, I started, my father, just as a bit of background, my father was a factory worker, you know. He had to quit school at 14. Very, very bright guy, you know, but and a very quiet mind. But his love of poetry was stunning. Mm-hmm. And his poet was Robert Burns, you know. And,
oh, yes.
Robert Burns, Scottish National Poet. The absolute celebration of the common man. That was, I think, Burns' dream was to, you know, put common men on level with all the princes and kings and all those bloodsuckers up there. Huh. And I bought into that from the beginning. And my dad was one of those guys that you could just say, hey, Dad, you know, can you recite such and such? And he would just start, you know, in his quiet, nice way, no pretension at all. He would recite these poems. And so I got this incredible gift of the appreciation of poetry really early on, you know. And so for me, it had worth. It had, my father thought so highly of Burns. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, the greatest thing I could do for him would be to write, you know, in a sense. But I didn't look at it, you know, seriously that way. But as it turns out, here, you know, all those years of growing up with that, and here I end up doing what I'm doing. And I must admit, he was very, very proud of what I managed to do and everything else. It meant a lot to me. So
I can imagine.
But that gift early on of the poetry, you know, was really a gift to get. And wowee, you know, it's a invaluable for me. So everything had worked, you know, it worked what I was doing, and I knew it had worked. And so I never had to doubt that, you know.
Wonderful.
It's never worked in a vacuum. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I absolutely did not know about that. So this is great to know about that.
Cool.
So in terms of coaching now, did you have as you were writing, whether it was earlier on in your life or later, did you have a coach, a mentor, or high school teacher who would give you feedback on your writing, encouragement, specific criticism?
I started writing poetry at 10. I'm sorry I got off topic there, but I started at 10. I wrote poems, you know, and I used to illustrate them as well because I like to draw.
Oh.
And my first experience of actually any adult, you know, seeing these poems was I wrote this poem about a ship and I drew a little ship on it too. And my friends in school in Scotland, they just loved this thing. And they took it up to this teacher we had, whose name was Mrs. McFadgen. And yes. She was an absolutely, I mean, no word of a lie, sadistic bitch. Oh. She was a very, very evil person. And I mean, deeply evil.
There's they exist, wrong I with can it, attest you know? To that.
They do, my friend. And everybody's got that story, Luke. And no matter who I talk to, they've got one teacher who was just the worst. And this woman was an absolute evil presence in the world. And she picked on me, like, mercilessly. And she strapped me every fucking day.
Oh, wow.
And every day I would not cry. I would not pull my hands away. And she was just undetermined I was going to do that. And I knew that's what she wanted to do. And I just never gave her that, you know. She wrecked me for sure for education, but I never gave her the satisfaction of that. So anyway, the boys took up this poem to her, you know, with the little book, and she looked at it, and she, I'll never forget it. She looked at it, she put a sneer on her face, and she said, "I copied it from someone," and basically tossed it across the desk. And I was just like so bummed. I was so thrilled. My pals liked it, you know, and everything else, and I liked it. And then she came out with that. But I remember thinking, well, you know, that's what you think. You know, I didn't even defend myself. I just said, all right, I just took it, you know.
Wow.
But, yeah, so no encouragement there. But, you know, down the road, I don't know. I don't think I had any mentors per se. But the poems turned into songs when I started listening to people like Joni Mitchell and Bruce Colburn and Leonard Cohen, all those guys. I thought, wow, you know, this is great. You can just put these things to lyric, to melody. So I just started writing more in a poetic a song form, as it were. And then I had this innate ability from God knows where to come up with melodies from nowhere. So that's when I started writing songs, and they really weren't very good, but the process was great fun for me, and it helped me out. And the more I wrote, you know, the easier it became, and the better it became, I should say. Yeah.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay. This is a lot more material. And they say, you know, I was going to launch in on Mozart. I don't understand classical music well enough to know this, but they do say he needed to pay his dues himself. Although what he did in the early years was better than people his age, it still wasn't anywhere near the caliber of how he developed through years and years of practice.
What he ended up doing, yes.
So you've already anticipated the question that I had next, which was about your influences. So you've named some singers. I can't recall whether Stan Rogers showed up there, but I guess he was maybe younger. Or
no,
he didn't.
No, I never really got into Stan. He was dead before I even listened to him. And my wife Beth bought me the album From Freshwater, and that's when I started appreciating him. But really, the one I listened to was Joni Mitchell, and the reason that was A, she was blonde and beautiful.
Yes.
But
yes.
Number one was she was such a poet, and I just remember the first album I got. You know, $2 it sat on the record mine, you know, and I opened it up and I read those lyrics before I even put the album on. And I remember thinking, she doesn't even need music. This is such beautiful poetry. It had to be like a ton of bricks. And then these melodies were just killer and her voice was great and all that stuff. But it gave me that sort of, that direction to go in, you know, like you can actually write poetry and put it to music. And, you know, it's every word of hers, there isn't a wasted word. In any of her stuff. I know she's written thousands of songs, or well, probably thousands, at least hundreds, and there isn't one wasted word. There isn't one word that jumps out at you and you go, why is that there?
Yes.
And that really hit me. That, I just thought, oh, that's succinct and perfect. And so she was a humongous influence on me, really, you know.
Okay, well, that...
Only because she was a poet first, you know.
Right. Interesting. Okay, this is very, very powerful stuff. I've said the same thing in terms of not a wasted word in, say, Jacques Brel's music, which it strikes me that...
Yes, yeah.
You can't replace any word, right?
No, it's just a superb, you know, just a superb way of writing, just an absolutely waste-free way of writing. And I know that doesn't come easily. The biggest crime and the biggest pitfall for writers these days, and when I do these workshops, I tell them that. The worst thing you can possibly do with a song is overwrite it.
Yes.
And you could come up with a great bunch of lines, but if you're just throwing them in there and they're not really fitting, then it's up to you to take out the pen. Keep them by all means, but scratch them out of that song you're writing, you know. And and that's what I try and tell kids, people. I mean, all the adults too, of course. And the biggest problem is they're trying to say far too much There's far too many words, and they lose the message they're trying to get across. And so I always try and tell them, you know, keep on track. Keep doing what you set out to do. Never mind your own brilliance and everything else. You're going to come up with great lines. Yes, you are. Keep them. They'll go on another song down the road. I know for a fact they will. But, you know, just try and get it so that you're, you know, you're saying everything you want to do and then get out. That's my idea. But, you know.
Interesting. It's, you know, what's interesting is basically it's the principle of parsimony, which is it's fundamental to scientific theorizing. They say, you know, good theory has to have nothing in excess. It just needs to have what it needs to explain the phenomenon, and then no more.
Yep.
So basically you're saying this happens in music, which is great. I like to hear that because what I'm trying to get at in interviewing you and other people is basically that intersection in the creative process in science and arts and other disciplines. Okay, so that's very cool. So I should ask you first, because we've been going at it for 34 minutes, how are you doing on time? Whether we should wrap
I'm
it
fine.
Up. No. You're okay?
No, man. That's why I picked 2 o'clock. And I'm sorry about that crack about by morning, you mean afternoon. But
that
you
was
know,
funny.
Musicians,
we loved it.
Like 10 o'clock in the morning just doesn't exist. You're sleeping as long as you can because you've been up till like we were at 4 o'clock last night.
Oh, my God.
It was great fun, man. Just, you know, talking music and hanging out. And it's great.
Beautiful. Well, it's very important as well for the brain. And my partner here loved your line as much as I did. That was very funny. So I wanted to ask you about, because we talked a little bit about your youth and now going into your 20s and 30s. I know that you worked in construction. You've already alluded to the fact that basically you may have been hammering nails on a roof, but you were also writing songs. So what kind of music and songwriting activities did you engage in during that time period?
I found it amazing in the morning. Like if I found a news, like to sound a bit redundant, but you know, I when I write about the world, my news comes through CBC Radio. That's the only station we got. It's still the only station I listen to. But, you know, it would give me food for thought on the way out to the truck, you know, and I'm driving to the site and it's like 6:30 and the sun's coming up and, you know, it's going to be a long, cold day. But, you know, I'd be working on a song on the way in, you know, and just to get an idea and I'd just start, you know, singing it on the way in. I'd get up on the roof and I'd sing it all day and I'd just keep working on it. So that's the only kind of process I had really, for that. But that was pretty constant. I wrote a lot at that time. It was just one of those times in life where, you know, ideas just kept ripping in. And, again, I never put any pressure on myself because I never expected to be doing anything with them. They just, were things I wanted to do. So, I lost the train of thought there, Luke. I'm awfully sorry.
Okay. No, this is great because, we were looking at your 20s and 30s and this is one way in which.
Sorry. You're right. Yep. And so, you know, so there I was in the working world and, I found it immensely interesting, I have to say. I mean, no word of a lie. I found what was going on with the boys that I was working with, what was going on around us. I found it all interesting, and I just wanted to encapsulate these little moments. Like, Working Poor is a song that, you know, I got the ideas for. I took all the jobs, not all the jobs, but some of the jobs I had, and I wrote a verse about each one, you know, and the last verse is, it's a father and son walking in through the factory gates together, you know. And I stopped at the lights. I had one more verse to go, you know, and this father and son walked across. And my heart just filled, you know. These two guys with their lunch pails, obvious father and son, through these gates together. And I just thought, what a beautiful thing, you know.
And it was
so melancholic and lovely, and I just wanted to put it in terms that people would recognize, you know, rather than, you know, trying to flower it up any. It was just bare bones of what exactly happened. So, and again, it's getting back to that being succinct thing. And so I wrote an awful lot about the working life, and only because that's what I was doing, and I wanted to give it just, you know, equal weight with artists and everybody else. I mean, everybody who gives into work every day, generally they're giving their best. That's what they've got to do.
Yes.
And that's what they've got in life. And so, you know, whatever you come to life, it behooves you to do your best at it. And to, and for somebody like me to say, well, you know, there's an awful lot of beauty in this and do that. And one song I use for an example of that when I'm teaching songwriting, there's a song called Hammers. And we're all up in the roof, you know, there's four of us stretched across this long roof. And roofing was wonderful because there's no saws or anything involved. You're just up. It's just a staccato head of these hammers, you know?
Yes.
And it's very, very peaceful. No one's coming up on the roof to see you when you're sitting on a little plank or three stories up. So this one day, man, no, this is no word of a lie. We're stretched out across this roof, and it's always this intermittent, very random hit of the hammers. Well, for four beats, everybody had hammered together, you know? It was just like, bang, bang,
wow.
Bang. Bang. Out of all this mayhem, there was this little thread running through it, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I'd just been reading this book, and everything just coalesced on the roof that day. And I had those four hits. It gave me the impetus to start the song. It gave me the melody. It gave me the lyric, and it gave me the rhythm. And, I happened to notice it was all, hammering in one row, and the other boys, it never even fazed them, they never heard it, didn't notice it, but I noticed it, and I wrote about it, and now I get to do this instead of hammering nails, so. But I remember it just hitting me so hard that it's like, hey, that's not supposed to be happening, so.
Wow.
Anyway, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's a great insight. Okay, so I had a, this is a question is probably not going to elicit any answer because most people don't do this, but I'm trying it out anyways because it's about working with other people's like stuff. Like Winston Churchill he would read Macaulay, if I'm pronouncing that name right, and then he'd copy that stuff out as a kid. He actually, as a young man, he copied out several times just to learn the way of writing. And Benjamin Franklin, Yeah,
really?
Benjamin Franklin did the same thing. I remember reading that in his autobiography. He mentioned that he did that.
Jesus.
So did you ever find patterns that you just thought were worth hammering into your own head from other people's work? I mean, you've alluded to Johnny Mitchell.
Yes, yeah.
As practice.
Well, that's tough. Pardon me?
As practice, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was always drawn to people who use words sparingly, and like John Prine is a great example of that. I found out a bunch of stuff about him later on, and when I was listening to his songs, they were ringing like a bell to me. There's this one great song. It's "Hello in There," I think it is, and apparently one of the lines is, "I'm going to go and call up Rudy." We worked together at the factory,
Right.
So I had a picture of Rudy in my head, and I had that whole scene together, and I thought, yeah, cool, I've been there, I've done that, and all that. Huh. And then I found out later, he got the idea for that, which was just, I thought, perfect, He was out there, and he's kind of working on the song, and the woman next door came out and called her dog, and her dog was Rudy.
Huh.
Oh, yeah, and I just...
Called up Rudy.
Oh, when I heard that, I was just like, oh, I do that, So... I thought I was on the right track there,
Interesting. Okay,
yeah.
So here's another one for you. Now, this one's about physical exercise. Now, physical exercise is great for the brain, right? And
absolutely.
And it's, as working in construction during that time, did you find that it was also like, you'd get that that feeling that, I had a good aerobic exercise and whether the the aerobic exercise, whether you notice that it helped with your mood or with your production of songs or not?
Yes, it does, and there's no doubt about it. And I think I was writing so much at that time just because I was doing what I was doing, And the other thing is, yes, you are kind of physically putting yourself out there, but at some point that becomes by rote, So it leaves your brain completely free to work on everything else. You know how to do a roof. You know how to frame a wall and all that stuff. So that's just coming naturally. You're not being slow. You're not being anything. You're just doing what you do. You're in constant motion all day. And I think that's why I wrote so much then was because, it gives you energy to move. And when you're moving, it just sets everything in motion. And again, we're right back to motion, I just realized. But, I think that's why I was so prolific during that time was I had, a great sources of inspiration, but I also had the energy,
Yes.
And now that I'm on tour, it's quite a different thing, There's not a lot of energy, man. It's like get in the car and drive, essentially. So.
Yeah,
that kind of movement kind of took place of the physical side of things. My production, as far as songs go, has tailed off, of course. because of doing this. But, you know, I just find they come when they come. I don't panic about it. But I think that's what's replaced the physical side of things. It's just this this constant stream of imagery coming through the windshield of the car and coming out in the people you meet and all that stuff. So, you know, I think that's what's taking its place.
Okay. Well, David Francie, I can't tell you how much of an honor and a pleasure it's been to have you take my phone call. You're a big part of my musical life because you're amongst my favorite artists, and we listen to a lot of your music. So this is very special to me in particular, and I've learned a lot about your creative process, and I'm sure that the people that will read this will also get some insights. So.
Oh man, I was very thrilled, Luke, I have to say. And like I said, I don't think very deeply about what I do. I just tend to do it. And I love those questions because they actually made me think about it, you know. And I just sometimes I think you can take for granted what you're given, and not for granted, but you just, you know, it just gets to the point where, you know, oh yeah, right, that's what I do, and you don't think about why. And I've absolutely enjoyed this, man. I have to say, completely.
Well, so, thank you very much,
and I'm very honored. I'm very honored to be asked. I'll tell you that. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And
this concludes the first episode of the Cognitive Productivity Podcast, a product of Cogzest. For more information on cognitive productivity, visit cogzest.com or check out my new book, Cognitive Productivity: The Art and Science of Using Knowledge to Become Profoundly Effective, available on leanpub.com. Thank you for listening.